is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
Ukraine conflict, an announcement by the President of the United States. This is London reporting. U.S. President Joe Biden says his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin was wrong to think Western resolve would, quote, crumble as the Ukraine conflict dragged on, as he announced that America will supply Ukraine with 31 advanced M1 Abrams tanks. Mr. Biden announced the decision at the White House, saying the tanks are needed to help the Ukrainians, quote, improve the ability to maneuver open terrain. This is part of the story. The president went on to say Germany has really stepped up. Germany, and the new report is Spain, is ready to send its German-built tanks to Ukraine. Poland and Finland had already indicated that they were ready, given German permission, to send German-built tanks to Ukraine. I welcome my colleague, Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army retired, CBS News, a visiting professor at Dickinson College, the CEO of Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy. Jeff, a very good evening to you. Suddenly it's raining German tanks, and now we hear that the M1 Abrams tank is on its way as well. There are other countries weighing in on this. The tanks are important as a sign of showing unanimity, but at the same time, they're offensive weapons, correct, Jeff? What does this scale of tank commitment mean, and what does Ukraine need to launch an offensive, if that's what this is about? Good evening to you.
Good evening to you, John, as well. Yes, the tank is designed for mobility, firepower, and shock action, primarily in offensive military operations, in combination, by the way, with mechanized infantry and normally self-propelled or at least additional long-range artillery. So I think we have to look at this additional amount of military equipment in the larger what the United States has provided, because just shortly before this announcement, we announced that we were going to provide several hundred armored personnel carriers, Bradleys, Strikers. Germans announced the Martyr, and several other countries also announced additional mechanized infantry vehicles. So we're now building a combined arms team for the Ukrainians for the much-expected counteroffensive we believe they're planning to conduct later this spring. Now, the Ukrainians, John, have said they need up to 300 tanks. My back-of-the-envelope calculation as this story is unfolding is we may fall short of that number, but right now, just based on what has been announced so far from Germany, from the United States, as well as 14 challengers from the United Kingdom and other countries, comes to around 150 or 200 tanks that will be arriving in Ukraine. But in many cases, particularly for the Abrams, the U.S.-made Abrams, those tanks will not arrive for several months.
Jeff, these different places issuing tanks, is this like having a Toyota and a Chevy and a Mercedes and a Tesla in the same garage? And is that a challenge to the engineers who must maintain that equipment?
It's an enormous challenge to the maintenance portion of the Ukraine, as well as the logistics portion of the Ukraine. Just consider the Leopard 2 tank and the Abrams for a moment. They fire different ammunition. They have much different maintenance requirements in terms of spare parts. The fire control and the electronics are totally different. So you have to create supply chains for relatively small numbers. The initial tranche of U.S. military equipment for tanks will only be 31. A supply line for those unique capabilities. They use different fuel. The M1 optimally uses JP4, basically jet fuel. The Leo 2 basically uses diesel. That's got to be factored into your supply line if you're Ukrainian. I think the other thing, and the unspoken problem here, John, as we provide Ukraine more and more sophisticated military hardware, whether it's Patriot, Abrams, Bradleys, Leos, or whatever, is this putting increasing pressure on the question of where will we put civilian contractors forward in Ukraine that can repair this equipment and get it rapidly back into the battlefield. Up until this point, we've either provided them sort of fire and forget weapons like Javelin, or we've been taking equipment all the way back to Germany for repair, which obviously is suboptimal and expands the amount of time that a piece of equipment that's damaged or needs repair is out of the fight until it can be repaired and returned.
In the 21st century, I am unfamiliar with what a tank unit consists of. I do have the reading I did about the Sherwood Rangers, who were a very famous British tank unit that landed in Normandy and proceeded all the way to Germany, fighting its way across the scale of Europe. And what I learned is the tanks that are in the front are a small piece of the larger deployment. The equipment feeding it, the ammo feeding it, the repair services, a tank without a turret that tows, several of those, all have to come along in order for that unit to stay in the field and stay fighting. Is that still true, Jeff? And so are we looking at just a small piece of the deployment that's necessary?
Absolutely, and a small piece of the training. You know, one thing that's been interesting to me is we've already begun so-called combined arms training for Ukrainian units, not individuals, but units, are being done in Germany. And this is where you integrate artillerymen, infantry, and tankers to try to get the maximum effect from all those disparate capabilities. We'll continue to expand upon that as we provide more and more of that equipment to provide that overall integrated capability on the battlefield that you described, which is going to be most effective in the conduct of offensive operations. It also requires recovery vehicles. And I noticed in the details of the U.S. announcement, we're going to provide up to eight what are called an M88. An M88 is a very large, heavy, tracked vehicle with a boom on it that is designed to tow a broken down tank, remove the engine if that has to be removed to have it repaired, et cetera. Obviously, an additional very important piece of equipment if you're going to maintain that weapon on the battlefield, but a piece of equipment itself that has to be maintained and crews taught how to properly operate and maintain it.
That's what the British unit had. They were driving Sherman tanks, and there was a Sherman without a turret that could get them out of trouble. They wanted to get out of trouble just as fast as they got into it. Now we move to another part of the battlefield you bring my attention to that's underway now, which is the artillery exchange, the Verdun battle underway. You send me a New York Times piece that requires some interpretation. Pentagon will increase artillery production sixfold. The Army's top acquisition official says production of the 155 millimeter shells badly needed by Kyiv will rise to 90,000 a month in 2 years. A long war, Jeff? Is that what we're looking at? The arsenal of democracy is preparing 24 and 25 shells?
That's exactly right, Jack. John, this just illustrates the larger question of the industrial base. You know, it's been very interesting to me as this war has gone on, we have seen more and more reports that Russia, Mr. Putin, is putting his economy on a war footing. We've seen public criticism by Mr. Putin of the leaders of certain sectors of the Russian wartime economy for not meeting requirements. I was just reading a report of Putin visiting a factory and telling the workers that what they were doing was a key part of the eventual success of Russia, once again painting this war as a metaphor to the great patriotic war of World War II. So the Russians have been really moving their industrial base in that direction. I think we've been slow to do so. And now this decision to expand artillery production is only one example of that. But moving us to about, by my calculation, 800 to 900,000 rounds of 155 artillery ammo production annually. When the war began, we were producing about 175,000 rounds annually. Well, the Ukrainians were expending at one point 6,000 rounds a day. Now, a portion of those were 152 millimeter that they had organically at the start, or they'd gotten from other Eastern European countries, or they'd captured from the Russians. But as the war has progressed, a greater and greater percentage of their artillery has been 155, and they're expending roughly the entire U.S. initial production rate every single month. And of course, on top of that, you've got additional requirements because of concerns of rising tension in Asia, which are going to put more and more pressure on an expansion of the industrial base to provide the ammunition, the equipment, the spare parts, et cetera, that the United States is going to need for its own war reserves and because of the growing challenges of Russia in Europe and China in Asia.
You remind me of another irony about the Second War. The Soviets, then now the Russians, don't last a month without the arsenal of democracy. It was Lend-Lease that kept them in the fight and made it possible to roll back the Germans from Stalingrad. Our factories, our equipment, our trucks, our shells, our people, both through the northern route and then flying the equipment into Alaska and then across to Siberia. It's a fact that that is generally misunderstood in Russia. They don't fight Europe without America's support. Are they aware of that, Jeff, that they don't have the factory base we do?
They really don't. I think they're beginning to realize that. And the other thing is, of course, they're dependent on a lot of the spare parts, particularly for smart weapon technology, that they got from the West, that they're not getting from the West because of the sanctions.
Right.
And we're seeing that, I think, revealed in them using more and more what I would call dumb bombs and dumb missiles in their assaults on the Ukraine. That most recent attack, for example, on Dnipro, devastating, killing over 50 civilians when a missile strikes an apartment building. That particular missile was designed in the 1960s as an anti-ship missile against aircraft carriers, and is very old and relatively inaccurate. So if that's what they're using right now, it suggests that their arsenal of smarter weapons has begun to dwindle. And we've also got these amazing reports, of course, of the Russians purchasing artillery ammunition from North Korea, further suggesting that their industrial base can't keep a pace.
Jeff, this is escalating. This is darkness coming over Ukraine. Both sides are putting their chips in, and more chips. There's no easy end to this, is there, Jeff? There's nothing we can see now. When the tanks join the fight, that's an engagement that will last a while.
Well, it could, John, or we could see one side or the other collapse. I think the next few months, however, are clearly going to be decisive in this particular conflict. There's no doubt about it that I firmly believe with this announcement today of tanks going to Ukraine, the response is privately in Moscow is going to be to accelerate the pace of preparation for an offensive in the springtime by the Russians. I would not be surprised to hear in the next few days a formal announcement of an increased mobilization of manpower by Russia. We talked about their increasing of their production base. We know they just put General Gerasimov in charge of the entire operations in Ukraine, trying to improve and redesign their overall command and control for offensive operations in Ukraine. But there is absolutely zero evidence that I see, John, of Mr. Putin, despite the fact that this week it was reported by some intelligence sectors that the Russians may have suffered now over 190,000 casualties since this war began. I see no evidence of Mr. Putin thinking at all about an exit ramp or any type of negotiations.
What followed Verdun was the Somme. What followed the Somme was the revolt in the French army, and what followed that were the Americans showing up to win the war in 17 and 18, if it was called a win. In other words, escalation, escalation, escalation until the Germans bugged out. Is that what you're imagining, Jeff? One side is going to collapse.
I think that may well be the case, John, but certainly or escalate. And we have to keep in mind that though as we move to more and more sophisticated and offensive military capabilities like tanks, we're suggesting that the possibility of Russia escalating to nuclear weapons is becoming less and less possible. Those red lines the Russians tried to paint early on seems to be ones they weren't willing to stick to. Now, if we should see, though, a collapse or Russia losing ground rapidly, might Mr. Putin reconsider and perhaps consider escalating to the use of nuclear weapons? I think it has to be something that worries people in Washington, because certainly that probability of escalating the nuclear weapons, if in fact Russia were to start losing, is not zero.
NATO is in the fight. When we come back, what does that mean for the map of Europe? Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army retired, artilleryman, CBS News, a visiting professor at Dickinson College, the CEO of Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy. I'm John Batchelor.